Testing. Testing.
Starting your phone?
Hey!
That's why I'm
basically sitting there. Exactly. I knew that.
I'm going to call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this February 8th and open up a work session for the purpose of introducing a committee bill. John Hayden?
Chair Greenlee, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill, LC 3631, as of 2/7/17.
You remember, we'll remind you once more that the acceptance of a committee bill in no way foreshadows a vote for it, either by you as individuals or by us as a committee. Representative Hayden moves, what is it? LC 3631, dated 2/7/17, to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So move. Close the work session. I'm going to open a public hearing.
Protest vote.
No. Control. I thought you were...
I don't like the committee.
I'm sorry, was there a comment? I'm sorry. You want to make your usual objection?
Yes, the usual objection.
You need to open
a Bulin, open. Reopen the work session. Introduction of a committee bill. Representative Bueller votes no.
Yeah.
He's just sometimes mean.
Just have to be difficult.
Close the work session. Thank you, Representative Bueller.
My pleasure.
Can open a public hearing on House Bill 2114. And I have the opportunity, since it's my bill, to say a word before the Attorney General joins us to say a word. 2114 is a very simple bill. It takes a little step in dealing with the problem we have now with opioid and opiate addiction. We have a mass problem that the Attorney General will speak to. This is a very simple bill, and all this bill does is limit the number of doses that a physician can prescribe of opioid or opiate on the first visit for this condition with a patient. Very simple, very straightforward. Will it solve the whole problem? No, but it will make it a little easier for us to keep the problem under control. And I'll call our Attorney General to the stand and let her really tell you what's going on. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Noce, members of the committee. My name's Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm Oregon's Attorney General. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2114. As Oregon's Attorney General, I am a member of the National Association of Attorneys General, also called NAG, unfortunately. As a member of this association, I attend briefings on the issues we attorneys general view as a common problem across all states, regardless of political affiliation, urban-rural divide, or physical location. Opiate addiction is in the very highest category of areas of shared concern among all attorneys general. I would say just about every meeting I've attended during the last 4 years, there's been some kind of a presentation on this topic by one or the other of the states, or often a group of the states. Abuse of both pharmaceutical and illegally derived opiates is spreading like wildfire across our country, and Oregon is one of the states hardest hit by this epidemic. Opiates have been a recognized and medically sanctioned method of pain management for hundreds of years. The medical use of the opium poppy predates industrialized society, and the World Health Organization recognizes the innumerable benefits of controlled opiate ingestion for many patients with pain-related conditions. Unfortunately, we've learned that even when used as directed, the risk of overdose and addiction has reached unacceptable levels. Nationally, from 2000 to 2014, nearly 500,000 people died from drug overdose. The rate of prescription opioid overdoses has quadrupled since 1999, and the numbers continue to climb. In 2015, opioids killed more than 33,000 people in the United States, the highest number in history. We have every reason to believe that this dark number, which has been elevated repeatedly across recent years, will only grow higher without a targeted intervention effort designed to reduce the ready supply of this useful but also potentially lethal substance. Here in Oregon, prescription drug overdoses resulting in death more than doubled between 2000 and 2011. Besides the tragedy of the lives lost, we also pay the innumerable health care costs associated with opioid abuse and addiction, including the inevitable use of emergency medical services. According to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, emergency room visits for opioids increased 114% between 2004 and 2011, with 24 to 27% of those visits resulting in subsequent hospitalization. In Oregon, the frequency of ER visits and reliance on these very expensive medical services is even higher. While this problem is certainly complicated, encompassing our medical systems, our criminal justice systems, and other important links in the broader chain of social service delivery, solutions exist. One component of the solution is to reduce and control the prescription of pain medication. This will in turn work to control opportunities for the accidental creation of new addicts. The Center for Disease Control has issued guidance to prescribing physicians, making clear that, except in unusual cases, the prescription of opiates for the purpose of managing acute pain should be limited to less than a week of supply. However, and despite these clear guidelines, we are still seeing the routine prescription of substantially larger supplies of opiates for the management of pain in very conventional cases, root canals, small surgeries, pulled muscles. In 2014, enough opiates were prescribed in Oregon for nearly every person in the state to have their own bottle. Because of the profound feeling of relaxation and wellness that can accompany the consumption of an opiate, an oversupply will often be consumed by the patient until the supply is exhausted and the risk of addiction vastly elevated. Even a patient who voluntarily ceases her consumption of opiates prior to exhausting her prescription may simply leave the unused pills in her bathroom cabinet, where they will sit, often unattended, presenting an easy opportunity for diversion into the lucrative underground street market, where these pills are sold for 5 to 10 times their retail price. This helps to explain why some experts estimate that the illegal trafficking in prescription drugs may now be a $1 billion industry. House Bill 2114 will reduce the risk of abuse, diversion, and addiction by reducing the number of opioids in circulation. House Bill 2114 requires any prescribing physician to limit an initial prescription for an opiate used for pain management to 7 days, consistent with the outer limits already designated as appropriate by the CDC. If a prescriber wishes to prescribe an amount in excess of 7 days, they can do so. They are required only to document the reasons for this decision. In 2013, an Oregon task force convened as part of the National Governors Association Task Force on Prescription Drug Abuse issued a number of recommendations, including that we need fewer pills in circulation, noting that, quote, the focus of Oregon's approach should be on changing prescriber and patient behaviors so there are fewer prescriptions for fewer pills. I agree. House Bill 2114 will reduce the number of pills in circulation subject to abuse or diversion. This means there will be fewer pills left over after a surgery or medical treatment that can end up in the wrong hands. House Bill 2114 also reduced the risk of accidental addiction. Accidental addiction ruins the lives that it touches, and the tragedy is the ease with which a person can become an addict simply by taking one pill a day, just like the doctor tells you, until the supply runs out. Importantly, House Bill 2114 still leaves the judgment call to the doctor and does not force a particular result. They just have to note in the patient's chart the specific reason for a longer dose. This fairly balances the need to respect the sanctity of the relationship between doctor and patient with the larger social interest in curbing the oversupply of opiates, not just on our streets, but in our bathroom cabinets. Finally, House Bill 2114 will protect our children from opioid addiction by requiring prescribers to have a conversation with parents or guardians about the risks of opioid use while adhering to the same 7-day limit applicable to adults. Ending Oregon's opiate addiction is about the curtailment of both supply and demand, preventing pills from diversion to the illegal street markets, and working to prevent the creation of new addicts. And this bill does both. So I do want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. And we are open for questions. And I want to apologize. I missed acknowledging Vice Chair Representative Hayden. Thank you.
Are there questions with the Attorney General? Representative Buehler?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I appreciate you working on this problem. I feel equally passionate about it. So from reading this quickly, what is the penalty if a provider provides over 7-day supply and it's not one of the exceptions?
Right. I don't think there's a very clear penalty stated in this law. I'm not sure what Representative Green like had in mind in particular, but I think that for beginning, certainly the medical board would want to play a role in terms of regulating and setting rules that would be appropriate if the legislation passes. I would hope that. And I want to thank you, Representative Buehler, for your hard work on this. Really appreciate it. Let me just go to the last part, which has just been pointed out here, that any person who violates the law would be subject to a Class A misdemeanor. But in addition, there would certainly be some kind of regulatory aspects with respect to the medical board.
Can I have a follow-up question? So is there any other precedent in Oregon law that criminalizes a medical practice like this?
Well, absolutely. Certainly if doctors, like anybody else, were involved in the unlawful distribution of drugs of any kind, that would be certainly a violation of the law. So this would add to the current set of laws that we have with regard to controlled substances.
But it's about intention. So the intention wasn't to in this case, their just intent is to treat someone's pain. It's just outside of the criteria that's in this law.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't see it as necessary. It is somewhat different. You could say that the death with dignity law certainly would also be a law to look at in terms of some kind of analogies with respect to violations of the law by the medical community. That's just one example that I think that this legislature has probably considered in adopting that legislation. Or excuse me, not in adopting it, but in the people adopted that one, so excuse me for that. But in any event, that would apply.
Maybe just make a comment.
Please.
I just caution us to try to legislate the practice of medicine. You know, one of the drivers that's well recognized of this problem is when this august legislative body made it mandatory for physicians to be educated to prescribe more narcotics because we were not effectively treating pain. At least that was the opinion of the legislature. And
so you can't be brilliant and consistent.
Yeah. So now we're trying to take care of that error. So I just caution us to, because sometimes you have broad unintended effects,
right,
even well intentioned.
Representative Buehler, I agree with you. I think that this House bill is very carefully crafted to keep doctors from being put in unwittingly into situations where they might violate the law. It's very clear what they would need to do in order to create an exception to the basic rule of the 7-day, no longer than 7-day prescription. So I don't see this as being a gotcha type of law where doctors would be subject to that sort of concern or difficulty.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. In looking at the bill and reading the bill, I fail to see where there could be any sort of criminal punitive actions brought against a prescribing physician or dentist or other, because the exemptions are so large for acute medical condition, for chronic medical condition, and so forth. That really is going to encompass every medical condition. Really, what we're talking about here is punitive or corrective actions for failure to document, right? How could they attach to any, under this, any prescription being written, because the exemptions are so large and encompasses, in my opinion, pretty much all conditions, and some would argue that a root canal is not minor. I've done a lot. Some root canals. It's kind of a joke there. But
yeah, was that funny?
If you do,
if had one.
It's different if you do root canals than if you receive root canals. But more to the point, you're really talking about failure to document, which would be controlled under the administrative rule of the particular practitioner's board, right? So how do we get to criminal then?
Well, we might need the LC in to talk about this, but those criminal penalties are in Section 3, for violation of Section 3. The change in the statute is in Section 2, and I'm not sure that the criminal penalties under that circumstance would say very specifically the violation of this section applies to the second section.
Yeah. It was confusing
Chair Greenlink,
to me.
Vice Chair Hayden,
exactly
I believe
lawyer.
It does state that it is applicable to Section 2 in Section A, 1A. However, I might beg to differ as far as whether it covers every possible situation. I wouldn't want to argue with you about root canal. Fortunately, I haven't had one yet. But it does focus primarily on documentation. That's absolutely correct. So if it is not properly documented, or if it turns out the condition is not such that it would fit within one of these four categories, then it could be subject to the penalties listed.
Can you help me with that? I'm looking on page 2 of the bill. I hate to admit, it's my bill. I don't know the answer to this.
But well, let's
on
see.
On line 15 on the second page.
Okay.
It says any person who violates this section with respect to, and talks about those. This section is Section 3, isn't it?
Well, I have or Section 2 of this 2017 Act in bold, and I may be looking in right. the wrong place, but under 4759141A. So I do think that it appears to have been added to apply to Section 2.
Yeah, no. That's
Section 2 then referring back to the...
It's up in line
exceptions.
10.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you.
Yes, certainly.
See, you can practice law and really feel good about it. Now.
I feel like I've been practicing law a lot today.
Representative Hack?
Schedule 1, 2, 3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hayden covered my question. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Overall, I really like the bill. I wondered if you had considered any exception also, which would be subject to documentation for people that... may have a broken leg and live in a rural area, and it would be very hard to get to a pharmacy. There's an access issue at all with a 7-day, and whether that should be considered one of the exemptions.
Well, we're in public testimony here. We can wait till we get into the work session, but I suspect there are going to be other proposed amendments, and if you'd like us to consider an amendment to make a special exception in rural areas. I think the opiate problem in rural areas is probably just as bad as it is here. I think I was really tempted on this issue when my wife had surgery and then ended up with 150 Percodan as a way out the door, and I calculated that I could sell those on the street for more than my annual salary in the state legislature.
Don't tell us if
you
did.
Be very clear what the problem was. I decided not to do that.
The visual image you just gave me, Representative Greenlink.
Representative Kenny Geyer, that with prescriptions by mail being much more awesome. Common these days, that more than likely it would be possible to, still the 7 days would be a sufficient period of time unless there's a big snowstorm or something like that, which we have been experiencing. But I would urge you, as you have your work sessions, to consider that there are ways these days, thankfully, of obtaining prescriptions. Dr. Bueller's already objected to my statement, so I will add that I'm not an expert in this area, but just wanted to add that comment as something to consider.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me today. I really appreciate it, and happy to join you, Chair, in this important bill.
Thank you so much. We have a few folks who want to provide some testimony, so would you call the first panel, Madam Administrator?
Dr. Andy, and I apologize, Antonadiscus? And Dr. Ron Bonanno, Hans Notenboom,
any order you want, but please identify yourself when you begin.
All right. I'm Andy Antoniscus, so Chair Greenlink and members of the committee. I'm an internist, addiction medicine doctor. I'm past president of the Oregon Society of Addiction Medicine and was the medical director of the Providence Portland Chemical Dependency Program for 33 years until I retired about 2 years ago. So in my practice in the addiction field, I'm certainly well aware of the significant impact opioids has had on individual patients, family, and society overall. I understand the concerns and intent of House Bill 2114, I think, is a good one, but I have some concerns about this being the wrong solution and some unintended consequences that you've already kind of brought up in some of the previous discussion that may need to be developed. I also am not aware if the committee understands there's been a work group that's been going on with the Oregon Health Authority around the opioid prescribing. There's a task force that began meeting shortly after the CDC guidelines were published last spring. And this group has been meeting throughout the summer and this fall. It's a multidisciplinary group that includes the Oregon Pain Commission, the Oregon Medical Board, nurses, addiction medicine physicians, mental health providers, substance abuse providers, pharmacists, dentists. It's a huge multidisciplinary group. And we met to try to see what we should do in Oregon, because we all recognize that there's a problem. And we also decided that to endorse the CDC guidelines, but felt that there were some very specific Oregon needs that also were not addressed in the CDC guidelines. And one of these had to do around the treatment of acute pain and giving the physicians and dentists and other prescribers some guidelines or recommendations about how to manage that. And included in the Oregon-specific guidelines is the limitation of the number of medications that should be dispensed to a 7-day supply for acute pain. And subsequently, after review, the CDC awarded a grant to the Oregon Health Authority for dissemination of these guidelines and implementation in the physician practices. And that is already well underway with the Oregon Health Authority and groups that are meeting. And I'm on the group that's actually meeting currently to how we implement this. And part of the challenges, as you've already brought up, has to do around the differences in practices around large communities that have an integrated medical group versus small providers in rural communities and the needs that those providers are going to have. So the work is well underway about the education and actually hopefully becoming the standard of care with the CDC guidelines and the Oregon-specific recommendations are included for that becoming the practice of care in the state of Oregon. And again, that would include the limiting the numbers of opiates for an acute prescription to a limited number of 7 days to begin with. The Oregon Medical Association obviously has been involved in the past and recognizes this as a problem. Our whole annual meeting last fall was a day symposium that was around the opioid addiction problem. We had a newsletter that is published quarterly that one whole issue was around the opioid issue and was disseminated to providers. So, and you know, the integration of all of this into medical records and on how that would happen is going to be a challenge, because that is one of the problems that we've already learned in with the task force, is that working particularly with Epic and some of the healthcare providers, it is a real challenge for them of how they integrate that into their system. And so there's lots of roadblocks in regards to how to do this, but the work is well underway already for this to happen, and I think
it shouldn't be a problem then.
Well, from the standpoint of developing, you know, the education for the providers, and again, I have some concerns about, again, the legal consequences and unintended consequences of codifying this into legislation, as previously said, about, you know, how, you know, having providers, how they practice medicine becoming legislation.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Questions? Chair Greenlich, thank you for the opportunity to testify here on 2114. I need to correct the record. My name is Mark Bonanno. I'm general counsel for the OMA. While I have a Juris Doctor, that doesn't mean I practice medicine. So again, thank you. We've submitted some written testimony. I'm just going to cover the highlights for you.
Please.
And again, I'll pick up where Dr. Antoniscus left off on unintended consequences. We need to keep our frontline practitioners as partners in this crisis as we move forward. The bill does have that unintended effect of criminalizing prescription writing. Even though it might be, you know, a Class A, Class B, Class C misdemeanor, it's still a criminal penalty. And there's a stigma surrounding that, and there's a fear factor surrounding that. And I think we need to be very careful when we criminalize conduct, particularly with respect to the practice of medicine, even though this bill goes beyond just physicians. It's any practitioner that can prescribe in the state of Oregon. So I would just caution us to be careful. We don't want the pendulum to swing all the way back to undertreatment of pain if people just stop writing prescriptions altogether out of fear of criminal penalty. So I think we just need to think that through a little bit. The second thing that we highlight in our written testimony is, you know, taking these guidelines that have been in development over the past few years, they're very new, they're very recent, and codifying some of the standards that we're starting to see emerge from those guidelines and fixing at a point in time through statute a clinical standard. We'd much prefer to see our agencies, our legislative body, endorse these guidelines as state policy rather than fix them into a statute. Why is that? Because we're developing a lot of evidence, clinical evidence-based guidelines here, and that's going to shift over time. The silver lining with the focusing on this crisis is that we're starting to see more clinical research being done. We're really trying to get a handle on what's effective medical treatment in terms of both medication as well as non-medication therapies for the treatment of pain. And the final point addresses on the rural aspect that we need to factor in here. You know, sometimes it does take up to an hour to drive to a pharmacy in rural Oregon. And because this bill sweeps in all schedules of drugs, not just Schedule 2, things like Schedule 5, which is on the low end of risk for dependence, such as a cough syrup with codeine, that could require multiple trips to a pharmacy. So I'll stop and let...
Can I ask, is the OMA taking a formal position on this bill?
We support the intent. We just want to see this do the right thing.
But are you opposing the bill? Or are you recommending changes?
If it maintains the criminal penalties, I think we would have to. But we're open to seeing amendments to this. We're open to working on it.
Chair Greenlich, my name is Hans Notenboom. I'm an emergency physician and the current president of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to speak today and talk a little bit about our experience in this opioid crisis. And I think that much of the thoughts of where this originates often comes from, is this an emergency department problem? And I want to talk a little bit about that. In the emergency department, we're actually only responsible for about 4.7% of these prescriptions nationwide. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the strategies that we've taken on to try to improve this situation.
I appreciate you coming down, but if you limit it essentially to how this bill works, it would be very helpful.
Right. So I want to echo some of the same comments. We agree that we have a role in this, and we think that this needs to be improved. We agree with the intent of the bill, but again, some of the ways or pathways of getting there are a little bit outside of what we feel comfortable with, and we already have some good things in place. So, for example, we've created the Emergency Department Opioid Prescribing Guidelines, 17 different points that we have shared throughout the state with our providers. We have discussions and education throughout the state that we share at things such as conferences. We just had our winter conference where we had an entire talk dedicated to this. And we also employ usefully things such as the prescription drug monitoring program throughout the state and the newer use of the emergency department information exchange, which allows us to share plans of care and also see all of the different scheduled medications that people are prescribing. With this, we've had some success in that we have been, according to the Board of Preventive Medicine, the highest amount of kind of moving the needle. We've had about a 9% decrease in our prescription, and as a result of that, we have room to do more. We've had some successful things that we are implementing now, and I think that with this being on the front burner, we're getting more and more education, more exposure, and I think this is becoming the standard like we heard before. So I think that we have successful processes in place, and I guess that I would say that we have the same concerns about some of the particulars with regards to this. We think that we can use guidelines, and we think that we can use evidence-based medicine. We see a wide range of people from all socioeconomic situations with all sorts of different complaints of injuries or illnesses. So we have to take all of those into account, and we are subject matter experts that do a good job at this right now in our theory, in that we're already trying to curb this, and we're actively working on many of the same boards and many of the same groups to try and tackle this head on.
I would ask all of you to, if you have proposals, if you do support the principle, you have some amendment proposals, it would be very helpful if you get them into the hopper as we consider this further. Representative Hayden?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I've got a question for the council. How, if this were to move forward, could you help me understand how you can get from HIPAA compliance into the criminal justice system? Let's say somebody prescribes 20 days or 21 days worth of something, and for some reason that's reported and there's an investigation. Your criminal justice system going to have access to that medical record to investigate that, or are you going to have OMA embed, the boards into the criminal justice system? How do you even put those two together and stay HIPAA compliant?
Representative Hayden, Chair Greenlick, it's an excellent question. Enforcement of any type of statute that involves a criminal penalty. Is the question as to how do you get the data? How does the complaint, or where does the complaint originate? Who's submitting that? And then what access to data is needed? Usually that's done through a subpoena process. So there are exceptions under federal HIPAA with respect to law enforcement activity. And licensing boards as well use that exception to gain access to information.
No follow-up. Seems a little excessive to get to something that they can just turn around and say, well, that was a chronic or that was an acute medical condition. So it really comes back to their documentation of that.
Representative Hayden, Chair Greenlick, yes, but the question I have would be, and the reason why I think your question is a good one, what's that process look like? Do you need to go through the subpoena process to gain access to a medical record to determine whether or not there was proper documentation? So I think it's a good question.
President Kennemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Antoniscus, I think I got it close anyhow, excuse me.
Yes, right.
Question about the task force. I'm very interested in this. It seems like a really logical place to try to work to resolution. I have a couple of questions about it. One, is it inclusive of all who have a prescription privilege for these kinds of drugs? And secondly, you've been meeting for a while. Is there a date that we expect that you will be producing some recommendations, or is it stronger than recommendations? What do you produce?
And again, those are already there, and so I would suggest that that you obtain the record, because it's already been implemented and is available. Dr. Katrina Hedberg at the Oregon Health Division, you know, she's been chair of our task force and heading things up, and again, as I said, it's a very large group. It's almost every prescriber that we could think of. There's naturopaths, dentists, physicians. I mean, anybody who would have a stake in this is involved in that, and that report has already been published, and now it's the implementation and education piece that's being worked on and implemented. And as I mentioned, the CDC grant was just awarded within the last few weeks, and so work is already well underway of how we get physicians educated and involved in getting this hopefully to eventually be the standard of care in a very quick manner and not dragging our feet. That's one of the things with the whole group has been saying. We can't keep working on that. We need to get it implemented and get going, and that's a vital step.
Follow up, if I may.
Yes, briefly.
And I know it's a complicated issue, but I'm trying to simplify it here. In basically your recommendations in most simplistic form, are they consistent with 7-day prescriptions and that kind of thing?
Again, the CDC had 12 specific recommendations, and their gist was around the management of chronic pain and how you evaluate patients and treating them and managing them. And the Oregon Task Force specifically, we realized there were some organ-specific issues like the medical marijuana and now the legalized marijuana issues and how you deal with those patients, but also realized that the CDC guidelines did not deal specifically. They had a very brief comment about acute pain but didn't go into that in much detail. We felt that was a very important issue to address, and so we came up with very specific recommendations, and included in that were you should not be prescribing opioids if you can, if there are other alternatives, number one. And if you are prescribing opioids, it should be prescribed for 7 days or less. And again, the documentation piece is written in there over and over again. Document, document, document. It's all there in the recommendations.
Thank you.
So those should be readily available. And if you can't access them, I'm sure Dr. Hedberg would be glad to get those to you.
I think we're passing a report on now.
Great.
Thank you very much. Would you call the next panel, please?
Sure. Jessica Adamson and B.J. Kavner.
We got a fair amount of business to do yet today. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. We absolutely support the goals of this legislation. Unfortunately, I'm here today to oppose it as it's written. We have really dug in as a organization to ensure that our clinicians, whether in our hospitals or in our medical groups, are prescribing medication that is necessary, but no more than is necessary to really get ahead and make sure that we are responding to this crisis. However, as we read this legislation, specifically on page 2, line 2, this isn't solely applicable, again, as we read it, to practitioners. It also encompasses those who dispense or pharmacists. And we operate a wide range of pharmacies. We operate inpatient pharmacy, but we also have retail clinics. And we serve not only Providence patients, but those who may not be seen in our clinics or in our hospitals. We do not have access to their electronic health record. So we don't know whether or not proper documentation would have occurred. And being able to ensure that that is in fact correct, given the level of penalty in Section 3, we would be very concerned about the ability and the impact on our pharmacists and on our pharmacies. So if this bill is to move forward, at a minimum, we would ask for clarity that pharmacists can rely on the piece of paper in front of them as having that they are not liable to check and make sure that the proper documentation has or has not occurred, because that creates a dynamic and an accountability for our is this an acute medical condition or not? Pharmacists aren't going to know that, and we aren't going to be able to look in the record and say that's proper or not. And being criminally liable for that, it seems unreasonable in this case. And we don't believe that that was the intent of the legislation, but we just feel very strongly that that would need to be clarified. The other thing that my team, both my hospital and pharmacy teams and our other folks within our organization would like me to raise is a concern that absent fixing that and maybe some other unintended consequences in this bill, we fear that pharmacists may decide that the safest thing to do is just to dispense 7 days, not to dispense 30 days if it's appropriate, but just to dispense seven so that you're not running afoul or potentially getting in trouble. That could have the very unintended consequence of increasing costs to the system, having folks visit their clinician multiple times, because you need a piece of paper, not just a called-in prescription for the Schedule II in order to get those filled. So we want to make sure that in whatever we do here, we don't create a situation where just automatically all prescriptions go to 7 days, because there are times where it is very appropriate for a 21-day script or a 30-day script. Those should not be as frequent as they are today. We absolutely agree with that. But there are appropriate times, and we don't want to default to a system where to protect folks from liability, it's only 7 days, and we create more utilization in the system, more cost to patients in terms of copays, more clogging up of primary care clinics than is necessary in cases where it is appropriate for a longer script. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It would be helpful if you have a suggested amendment to deal with that pharmacy problem. I think that was not really intended.
We would be happy to provide that. And again, it is our desire to work to a place where we are comfortable in this bill. We aren't just here as a no and to kill it. We just really feel strongly if this is going to move forward, we want to work to make sure that it's going to work.
Our desire is to make sure you feel comfortable.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Speaker, and excuse me, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, on behalf of my name is B.J. Kavanaugh, for the record. I'm with 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are the Chronic Care Collaborative for patients living with chronic health issues in Oregon. I echo what my colleague said in very much appreciating the intent of this bill. However, we do have some considerations about not only the act of potentially criminalizing providers and pharmacists in this, but also what we can do and what the needs of patients living with chronic health conditions and pain is. There are many patients who require ongoing medication who do not have a physical addiction or dependence on this. Instead of shouting this down, I'd like to offer some potential suggestions to this, and I will do so in an amendment. One of the examples might be making it simpler for patients to return unused medications to pharmacies or even to doctors' offices. The use of pain contracts.
We've got things on the way on that.
You'll
hear more about them.
You just got a free plug. The use of pain contracts for patients so providers are able to monitor adherence and to adjust medications if necessary to treat patients. Making it simpler to use alternative methods to treat pain and working with insurance providers to make sure that that's something that's uniform for patients. Looking at titrating dosage for pain medication on and off, especially for patients who are undergoing a procedure as a surgery or something like a broken bone, that have the provider say, you're going to experience X and Y with this, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to titrate you off over a period of 72 hours. We're concerned about the rural access that people would have. As my colleague said, all opiate medications currently require a hard copy of a script. There are a few examples for providers who are working with the DEA's electronic option, but that still is an encumbrance. And quite frankly, from a provider perspective, if you are a patient that's continuing to seek pain medication, little warning bells go off in your mind that this patient may be an addict. And that's an unfortunate characterization for a patient who's trying to simply seek the medication necessary to manage their pain. There's also been, because of our response to this and the considerations, there has been a move for some providers, rather, to prescribe less medication than patients actually need. I have an acquaintance who's a nurse in a hospice, and he's told me this on numerous occasions, that there are patients who are still in physical pain because their providers will not prescribe adequate amounts of medication.
You did check the exceptions in this, right?
I did. I did.
Like, for example, what you just said.
I did. But the problem, sir, is that there are many providers who are simply not willing to write that because they are concerned about their own liability.
That's true now.
Yes. Yes.
This gives them an hour. It doesn't make it any worse.
That's the intent. Mr. Chair.
It's not the intent, it's the language.
I understand, and that's the language of the bill, and hopefully that would be the case. Finally, if we have patients that are dealing with chronic pain issues, their pain should be managed by their primary care provider, but also in conjunction with a pain specialist. There are not nearly enough pain specialists throughout the state of Oregon, certainly not in the rural aspects, and I would imagine that we probably don't have enough in the CCO program to
meet.
Does
this bill change anything about that?
No, sir.
It allows for the treatment of chronic pain. It doesn't say anything about the supply of specialists. I'm not sure how it's relevant to what you're raising.
The relevance is that if we pass a law that looks to intent with the intent of criminalizing providers and prescribers and potentially patients, then that concerns me. It concerns me when we start to pass laws that tell doctors how to do their job.
Okay. So your testimony is about that or about chronic pain or about cancer patients?
My testimony is that as it stands now, we oppose the bill. We welcome the opportunity to work with you to find fixes.
So physicians ought to be able to do what they want to do in treating your patients?
Of course not.
Even if the patients don't want that?
Of course not. But there's a little Supreme Court case that we all are very well aware of, which also tried to tell providers and women what they could and couldn't access in the way of medical services. My concern, sir, is that we do something that is in the best interest of everybody. We all, if you haven't personally felt addiction or dealt with it in your life, you're very fortunate. I know I have, and I know many of you have as well. We want to prevent addiction. We want to prevent these deaths. We want to keep people healthy, and at the same time, for the patients that we represent and that we serve, we want to simply make certain that they're getting the adequate treatment that they need to manage their pain and go on with their lives.
Well, thanks for sharing. I think we need to move on.
Mr. Chair, I just have a comment. Looking at this Oregon opioid prescribing guidelines, they talk about the importance of or the reality that most need less than 3 days and certainly less than 7 days. And I guess what I'm wondering from, and I'd like an answer from OHA, not today, but they could send the committee a letter about whether or not this is enforced or whether or not it applies to physicians as a guideline and whether the medical board and other prescribers would be subject to this guidance.
Would you ask them? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We close the public hearing on House Bill 2114 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2301. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
That's right.
House Bill 2301 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. This separates the health licensing office into two groups, the health-related portion and a trade profession portion. Specifies circumstances under which the HLO is required or permitted to disclose information obtained during an investigation of certain professions, and it does multiple other things. Mr. Chair, we have Lillian Shirley from OHA and Sylvie Donaldson from the Health Licensing Office here to testify.
Please join us. Public Health Division luminaries are here today.
I was really glad I heard the last discussion. Chair Greenlee, Vice Chairs Hayden and Nose, and members of the committee, I am Lillian Shirley, and I'm the Public Health Director for the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2301. This is a housekeeping bill for the Oregon Health Authority, for which I'll speak to the components that impact the Public Health Division. But the majority of this bill is makes simple procedural changes that will align reporting and investigations for boards maintained by the Public Health Division's Health Licensing Office. And to to testify to that, I have with me Sylvia Donaldson, who is the director of the Health Licensing Office in the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. So, I'll turn it over to Sylvia.
Hi again. Sorry, guys. Yesterday, Chair Greenlee and members of the committee. I'm Sylvia Donaldson. Like she said, so two pieces of this bill affect us. One is to try and streamline our office. So as most of you know, we have 14 boards and programs. They all have their own set of statutes. And so this is trying to try
and we have proposals to add a few more.
That is very true. So it might be more than 14. So it separates them into two groups. So one was health-related professions, and the other group is trade professions. And then it tries to streamline the investigative process and the disclosure of records throughout the investigative process, and then the confidentiality, trying to keep the intent is to keep the person who made the complaint not be a public record if it's not needed. And again, it's a lot of health related cases. And then there are trade professions, which are more of your body art, which is your tattoo and body piercing, advanced aesthetics, and cosmetology. The other section of the bill that makes changes is related to environmental health and the environmental health registration individuals. So the intent was is to maintain the having to have a bachelor's degree and keeping the 45 science hours that are related to environmental sanitation as a qualification, but to not have the 45 science hours in the bachelor's degree. The intent of that is that if somebody was to come in and change their profession, or they already have a bachelor's degree and now I want to go into environmental sanitation, if I take those science classes after the bachelor's degree, they don't count, because the way that it's currently written, it has to be in the bachelor's degree, so I would have to get another bachelor's degree in environmental health. So that was the intent of that. And also, the currently with the way the bill is written, it's not including the educational requirement changes for the trainee, and then also eliminates the consistency of the people who are not required to register to be able to supervise the trainees. So the trainees have to have 2 years of education under supervision. DEQ is exempt from having to have their employees registered to environmental sanitation. However, they can be trainees, and changing the verbiage doesn't allow for that anymore, because they would have to be registered in order to train the trainees. So we do have some amendments that hopefully will be coming that trying to address those changes to, we want the 45 science hours, just not in the bachelor's degree, to consistently do it for the trainees and the registration for the permanent, and then to allow individuals with equal qualifications to be able to supervise the trainees.
I think we have those amendments.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, I have the request for the amendments. We are not in position.
No, I understand that.
Okay. Great.
Thank you, Sylvie. I'll briefly go over the remaining areas in the bill. One is it modifies the membership composition of the State Trauma Advisory Board, Area Trauma Advisory Boards, and the State Emergency Medical Services Committee. And it repeals the Oregon Pulse Registry Advisory Committee. And these two changes come from, the one is really just making sure, since the scope of the practice for both of those boards, the Trauma Board and the Emergency Medical Services Board, are worried about the same types of scope of services and protections for Oregonians. And it puts the chair of each board as an ex officio member on the other board, so that we can make sure that their work is aligned and in agreement from the get-go. And then the Oregon Pulse Registry Advisory Committee repeal actually comes from the advisory committee itself. When this was set up, there was a 5-year sunset clause on the committee, and the committee thinks that they've done their work, the rules are adequate, and things are kind of rolling along, and they made this request that we just continue with the work as it's outlined in statute.
Wasn't that 2009?
Correct. Yeah, 2009, Section 49.
Mm-hmm. Then what do we need an action for if they've been sunset?
Well, I don't know. There was a recommendation that we specifically asked to take it out.
Okay. We'll check it out.
We'll check that out. It seems odd.
The next section makes a series of changes that would bring our Oregon Cancer Registry, which is called OSCAR, is the short name that it goes by, into an alignment with the national standards while increasing the Oregon Health Authority's ability to efficiently provide high-quality data on Oregon's leading cause of death. So, again, this is an alignment. We had our registry before the national standards came out, so we'll be aligning them together. We also are asking in Section 43 and 45 to make changes that provide clarification for the oversight required for the provision of educational treatments for life-threatening allergies, adrenal insufficiency, and hypoglycemia. And this is, again, at the request of the practitioners themselves to expand who can actually be engaged. This is a workforce development improvement. And we want to align the state youth marijuana curriculum requirements with the local control curriculum adoption rules, and that is in Section 48. And then finally, we want to specifically change the annual date at which the healthcare-acquired infections data must be made public, and this is in Section 46 and 47. So, as you know, Oregon was very early on having healthcare-acquired infection reporting and tracking surveillance, and it includes infections caused by surgery, intravenous lines, the spread of influenza in medical facilities. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that this is still a very significant problem, and in response, in 2007, the Oregon Legislative Assembly created this Oregon's HAI Program and Advisory Committee, and that's House Bill 2524 and its companion Senate Bill 960. This advisory committee was charged with specifying infections in healthcare facilities, and we are required to report what we get reported to public health authorities, and then we are mandated by rule to have an annual report. Since then, federally, there has been specific infection requirements and recommendations put out, and the only difference is we're asking to move the date so that we can comply with the federal requirements. We report it up, and it also means that we can then support with our federal dollars for that work instead of Oregon dollars for the work.
What's the effect of it? Where is it moving?
April. It's moved. Usually the legislation, I think the National Service Report would be moving it to April, the end of April.
Currently it is?
Currently it's on a calendar year.
I'm sorry?
So it would be, you know, it would be just be the same. It would mean that it would mean that we wouldn't have to do two reports, basically. No, we could just use what we report up.
When is the current one due? Is it February?
End of the calendar year.
End of the calendar year.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Are there any questions? Thank you. We have one more witness coming up. We'll make sure we have your amendments.
We'll submit them. Thank you.
Can you call the next witness, please?
Andrea Salinas.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm here today for SEIU and AFSCME. Both clients have interest in this bill, and I've reached out to the agency, and they did explain the intent of this bill. I think both clients are concerned that these health-related cases could potentially deny due process and limit the person who has the complaint lodged against them from accessing information that would ultimately be their livelihoods actually you look
which
like
which section of the bill are you commenting on?
Section 2. It could be a complaint upon which their livelihoods actually rely. And so we need to make sure that the language is accurate and the intent of the language is congruent with that intent. And so we have, like I said, reached out to the agency, and basically we will be making sure that we work with them to provide any amendments.
That'd be great.
Thank you.
Do that quickly?
Yes.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3301 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2303. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2303 comes before you today at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. This changes the coordinated care organization reporting date to the authority from December 31 to October 1 of each year. Updates statutory language, deleting references of the Oregon Health Policy Board and research, since that department has been renamed and restructured, and it's renaming it to the Health and Policy and Analytics Division of the Oregon Health Authority. Mr. Chair, if the committee so chooses, the bill has a no revenue and a no fiscal impact on the bill should you decide to take action on this bill today.
Would you call the witnesses, please?
David Simnett from OHA.
Just one?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Hooper is going to go away, huh?
Uber is gone.
Yeah, Uber has RIP.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nosen, Vice Chair Hayden, and members of the committee. My name is David Simnett. I'm the Health Policy Director at the Oregon Health Authority and here to testify today in support of House Bill 2303. This is the Health Policy and Analytics Division's housekeeping bill, and as written, it does three things. First, this bill changes the due date for coordinated care organizations to submit primary care spend data, as required by Senate Bill 231, from December 31st to October 1st, and that change will allow the Oregon Health Authority the time necessary to produce and validate the annual primary care spending report. Second, the bill removes statutory references to the Office of Health Policy and Research and replaces them with the Health Policy and Analytics Division, the place in the Oregon Health Authority where these responsibilities now live. And finally, changes in Section 6 of the bill would give specific authority to the Health Policy and Analytics Division to collect certain data from hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers. I would like to note, however, that we are working on an amendment that would eliminate the changes to Section 6 and will also introduce some additional proposed changes.
What did you just say?
They have an amendment coming.
An amendment coming. And it eliminates the changes in Section 6 of the bill, and there are some additional changes that will be part of that amendment. And that's forthcoming, should be forthcoming. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? We will wait for your amendments.
All right.
And then assign somebody to carry it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2303. I'm going to simultaneously open the public hearing on House Bill 2341 and 2342. I'm going to ask the folks in DCVS to talk to us. We'll hear specifically about 2341 and hear some more general information that goes around 2342 about where we are right now in terms of relating our health insurance activities in the state to the federal government.
And you have Jessica on 2341 that she wants to speak whenever you want to call her up.
Okay. We'll save a little time for Jessica Adamson
certainly
to also comment.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It's useful to point out that agencies start drafting bills in the spring of the year before session begins, and so these bills have the marks of being drafted before the November election results and kind of the realities of the current health care discussion in Washington. We'll talk about two bills today, 2341, which is a bill that we've been bringing back to you pretty much continuously since we've began implementing the Affordable Care Act, which is what we've kind of colloquially called our Reconnect bill to the Affordable Care Act. The second bill is a placeholder bill for a set of concepts that we're unlikely to pursue. And when I talk about that bill, we'll dive into that a little bit. But I thought first I'd turn it to Laura Kelly Robison to talk about 2341.
Thanks, Pat, and good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Callie Robison. I'm the administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation within DCBS. And as Pat mentioned, House Bill 2341 is a bill that, similar to ones we've brought to you in the past few sessions, reconnecting Oregon law with federal law regulations and guidance. Even with the uncertainty that we have right now about the timing and the specifics of what changes could come in federal law or guidance, we still think it's important to continue to adjust Oregon law to reflect changes that have already occurred to date. Alignment between state and federal requirements we think are important to give consumers, providers, and insurers some certainty about our ability to continue to address regulatory issues as they come up, and to eliminate confusion as to conflicts in federal and state law. So I'll just talk about a few of the key elements of the bill, and then we're working on an amendment to address a couple of late-breaking things, and we'll probably still have things to come. But the pieces that are in the bill currently are replacing gender-specific terms with gender-neutral language to protect consumers from discrimination in accessing mandated coverage, revising the definition of adverse benefit determinations to reinforce mental health parity requirements, and clarifying the pharmacy exception process through which a member or a physician can request and gain access to clinically appropriate drugs on an expedited basis when necessary. Those are already in the bill as it's drafted. There are a couple of adjustments I mentioned that we're working on in an amendment. I'll highlight two of those. Right now, the bill includes language that removes the age limit for hearing aid coverage, and we had done that because there was kind of ongoing discussion about guidance coming from the federal government that would require us to remove that limit. No guidance was ever issued, and so truly in the spirit of this being a reconnect bill, we think we should remove that just because that wasn't actually done at the federal level at this point. The other piece is that at the end of last year, a law was passed called the 21st Century Cures Act, and did a number of things, but one of the main things that it did is it allowed small employers who had 50 or fewer full-time employees, and those employers who also did not offer a health benefit plan, to be able to contribute to a tax-sheltered health reimbursement account so that those employees could use that money to go buy, pay for premiums to buy individual coverage. Without changing Oregon law, federal law would supersede because there's a conflict right now, but we think it's better to align that so that it's clear that Oregon law and federal law are in concert. So those are the two pieces that we're going to be working on in the amendment, and then we think that there may be some other changes coming down the pike that we may want to be able to address just to make sure that we don't continue to perpetuate any conflicts. And I'm happy to answer any questions on 2341.
Specific question on 2341. Yeah. Before you go, let's ask Jessica to join us. Let's see what's on her mind, and we can talk about it together. Yes, Representative Kenimer?
Yeah, I guess I would ask you to go back over that issue of the tax credit. I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenimer, I'm happy to do that. So, the federal law now allows something that wasn't previously allowed. And so an employer who has 50 or fewer employees who also does not offer a health benefit plan to its employees can contribute money to a tax-sheltered account that the employee can then use to pay for premiums to buy coverage
Pre-tax dollars.
Pre-tax, mm-hmm. Yes. And then the employee can buy coverage in the individual market. Prior to the passage of that bill, federal law didn't allow for that to occur, and so we need to adjust Oregon law to just marry that
misunderstood.
Up.
Thank you.
Jessica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We are here, first and foremost, to thank the division for their willingness to work with us on some of our concerns, and their technical team and my technical regulatory folks have been in great conversation about this. We have put a letter on the record, and because of changes that we became aware of this afternoon, we wanted to highlight a couple of things that
We would say differently. The hearing aid issue was of great concern to us, and we really appreciate the willingness of the department to remove that language as part of the amendment, and we would encourage that language to be adopted. In addition, we are still having conversations about Section 7, the adverse benefit determinations. We are concerned that the language as it's written today could create some conflicts and confusion between guidance that's been issued by the agency and language in the bill. It is true that there are disparities in how some plans have implemented mental health parity laws. We don't see this language as resolving those issues, but potentially creating some conflict. Their team and our team are continuing to have those conversations, and we hope to resolve that and work that out in the amendment process. But again, just a very friendly appreciation for the department and all of their willingness to work with us on this. But because we had put this letter on the record, we wanted to clarify that work was ongoing and our appreciation for that.
You want to comment on that at all?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, yes, so I already mentioned the hearing aid issue, and then with respect to the adverse benefit determination, our teams are in contact and working through to see if we can iron out those issues. So that I should have mentioned that may also be something else that we clarify in the amendment. Great. We are working together on that.
Yeah, so we might expect more amendments besides the draft that we recently got. You'll be filtering that through the administrator.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Guyer, you had a question.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It actually has to do with the adverse benefit determinations as well. I wanted to understand how, as it's currently written, or what the intention is to try to increase mental health parity. And I know, I'll just add to that I know that you've done a data call on carriers to find out, to compare the rejections of reimbursement claims for mental health. So if you want to take any opportunity to say anything about that in relation to this particular piece and in relation to your bill. I know we keep trying to get at how do we get parity, and we're far from it. So trying to understand that piece.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Keeney-Geyer, I'm happy to help address that, and I'm actually going to ask Jeanette Taylor to join us. She's a senior policy analyst with the division, and so I think she can speak to some of the more of the details. But the one thing I did want to clarify is that we're not making new policy in this bill by reconnecting. We're really trying to make sure that we've got clarification that's hanging together with existing federal law and our existing interpretation. I think the issues that you reference around our work to ensure compliance with existing mental health parity laws and some of the work that we're doing to make sure that that's happening is ongoing and I think independent of what we're truing up here. But I'll let Jeanette introduce herself and talk through some more details.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. As Commissioner Calley,
introduce yourself.
Mentioned, my name is Jeanette Taylor, Senior Policy Analyst with the Division of Financial Regulation. So to answer your question, Representative Keeney-Geyer, the addition of the adverse, the mental health parity language to the definition of adverse benefit determination, that was brought in based on a couple FAQs issued by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that we believe articulated and this is just kind of to reinforce to consumers that if there is an adverse benefit determination associated with mental health parity requirements, that it's clear to them that they are assured the guarantees of adverse benefit determination, that they can request the kind of information that they would otherwise be able to access. So information as to why that determination was made. All of the details around the protocols, especially related to quantitative treatment limits, a number of things, so that we just brought that into the definition up front. And that's one that I know consumers rely on heavily because it's, you know, it's very clear that when anything is an adverse benefit determination, that can initiate the appeals process, and they have a lot of rights then to engage in. So that was based on a couple of FAQs that we're happy to provide as resources on the record. And so we are working with Providence just to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences with the language. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for that, and I would love to be involved in that conversation before you come to your conclusion about a possible amendment.
Okay, thank you. Pat, you have more?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Patrick Allen, Department of Consumer and Business Services. 2342 is a placeholder and continues to be a placeholder, but what it's a placeholder for, I guess, has changed potentially fairly dramatically over the last several months. You'll probably recall that we had a fairly exciting summer around rate filings with carriers dramatically changing the geography that they were serving and, of course, some fairly significant rate increases. And we spent and we worked our way through that and were able to on the fly address, if not outright fix, some issues for coverage for 2017. However, we spent the late part of summer and early fall working with OHA, the governor's office, and others to try to identify things that we could do in Oregon law that would try to further stabilize the market. And that's originally what 2342 was intended to be. We had whittled our way down from several dozen potential ideas to about 9 or 10 specific things that we thought could be changed to try to stabilize the individual market. We have decided to take those off the table now because, given the state of play at the federal level, we really don't know what constitutes making something better versus making something worse because we don't know what system it's going to fit into. And the federal situation, they've been in session for about 6 weeks now, and they sort of started with a single idea that was a bill that passed last Congress and was vetoed by the president. The range of play at the federal level has actually widened rather than narrowed from that, and there are now multiple plans, multiple ideas. The discussion about repeal and replace in some quarters has turned into repair and rebuild or other similar kinds of rhetoric, and so it's getting actually harder rather than easier to try to get a read on what kinds of changes to the Affordable Care Act are in the works. So we think the best thing to do from a stabilization standpoint is really, in terms of those concepts that we had considered, wait until the 18 short session to bring those back, at which point...
Or the special session we have in October to deal with.
I couldn't possibly comment on that. The two things, though, that we do believe that this remains a placeholder for are two problems that do remain that we think we will need to deal with this year, and they're this. First, it became clear to us as we looked at geography where there were we were losing carriers that if we got to the place where we didn't have any carriers, we didn't have any tools to be able to deal with that. And we believe we need some way to be able to deal with the possibility of carriers withdrawing and having counties or other segments of geography not have any carriers at all. Let me comment quickly. One of the problems that we're now going to be facing is how do carriers respond looking forward to 2018 to federal policy instability? There are a couple of ways they likely would do that. One is pricing in a factor for instability, and the other is simply deciding to withdraw from the market and not expose themselves to 2018. So that's the first piece. The second piece is we've got a rate filing calendar. And assuming the existence of healthcare.gov and a marketplace for the 2018 year, which is not a guaranteed assumption, I want to acknowledge, we've got a calendar that's fairly fixed. Rate filings are due around the beginning of May. We've got really a window through the rate filing and the rate filing appeal process to try to deal with new information up until about September 1st or so. After that, there's very little that we can do that currently to respond to new information. Personally, I think there's no chance we're going to have any clarity at the federal level before May 1st. I think it's remotely possible that we'll have some sense of clarity on some issues sometime between May and September, but I think that's a possibility, not a certainty. I think there's a high degree of likelihood that we're going to be learning about changes that could well impact the 2018 plan year very, very late in the process. And the other thing that this bill becomes a placeholder for then is some mechanism for us to try to be able to deal with that. Now, I've raised sort of two things that we need. We have candidly not fully engineered those yet, and so I can't tell you today what we think those need to be, and we're working on trying to I can tell you what it needs to be for the second issue. It's a bill that says we can do whatever we think best. The chances of getting that out of the building are pretty remote, so we're trying to figure out how to...
You can do whatever you do best after you check with us.
Right. So we're trying to engineer those, and so we would ask that you basically hang on to this bill as long as you can while we work through those issues and while we hope to see some clarity at the federal level and then come back and have a more meaningful conversation about what we're trying to respond to.
We'll hang on to it as long as we can, and then we'll send it over to the Rules Committee to keep it going longer so you can really be available right to them. We don't envy you trying to figure out what the hell is going on. I'll be glad to share my resource that I'm using. People ask me how I'm dealing with the potential of major changes. I explain I have a big sand pile and I have my head buried in it. I'll be happy to share my sand pile with you, Pat.
Appreciate that. I would offer to answer questions in the unlikely event that I can answer any of them at this point.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair.
Gentleman next.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. And
no. You
know? Either way.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I have a pile of sand from last session. I'll be glad to let you borrow it.
You can lease me a base in it.
Mr. Allen, just point of clarification. So you were anticipating a need to stabilize the individual market regardless of the election results in 2016?
That's correct.
Could you give me an idea of some of the measures that you were considering that would be a possibility?
Certainly, Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler, small bore ideas that Congress is actually now in the midst of considering, like shortening grace periods for non-payment, improving documentation standards for open enrollment or special enrollment periods, large-scale efforts like creation of a state reinsurance program to spread risk over a larger pool. And I'm going back next week with Jeremy Vandehey from the governor's office and Lynn Saxton from the health authority to meet with congressional committee staff and delegation staff and talk about some of those ideas that we think actually line up fairly well with some of what Congress is considering, and we may be able to get on the same page in some of those areas.
Quick follow-up.
Sure.
Can you give me an idea what it would do to premiums if you created a high-risk pool for the top 5% of medical services utilizers?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler, I
didn't hear you.
I asked if you give me an estimate of what premiums would look like if you created a high-risk pool for the top 5% of utilizers.
Yes, so Chair Greenlick, Representative Buehler, on the fly, I can't do the math to give you a sense of that. What we have found in high-risk pool discussions is it depends what do you mean by a high-risk pool. Mm-hmm. And it could range anywhere from what we did in the previous Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Program, which covered about 10,000 lives, with costs spread over the entire health market, so self-insureds and everybody else, with a benefit package that was not particularly rich, and fairly expensive premiums for those who were in the program. And I would sort of consider that kind of one bound of what you're talking about for high-risk pool. I think properly constructed reinsurance really addresses the same thing, which is how do you peel off the worst set of risks and try to spread the financial responsibility for that over a larger population. We can do some calculation on what effects we think that would have on premiums, but I don't have that kind of data today. Yeah.
The OMIP program, as I remember, the premiums covered only about 25% of the expenses, and the premium was about 2% across. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I remember vaguely the same thing, but I was we're digging into that now to just refresh our own memories about how that program exactly, how the numbers worked in that program.
Representative Nose?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you, I should probably know this, but what is the significance of May 1st?
It's about May 1st that the companies are required to file their rates for 2018. Sorry if I neglected to mention that.
Mr. Chair, your comment about the sandbox, I'd just like to suggest you greatly enlarge it and invite some of the rest of us.
I invite some companies. All right. Are there any other questions? Ms. Callie Robinson, let me ask you a question, if I may. You know, I have my perennial bill on medical trend going forward. Are we anywhere close on what your actual practice is compared to the bill, so I don't have to keep moving it forward? Let me explain just for a moment. All the insurance companies in their rate pick a medical trend, and along the line you're entitled to whatever opinion you want, but not your own facts. I was hoping that we could get the insurance division to create a process by which they get a medical trend before the rate increases are come forward that everybody would use or ask for exceptions from. I think you've been moving somewhat in that direction already. Can you tell me where you are on that?
Chair Greenlick, so I think two maybe interesting points of information related to that. So I think in terms of our current practice, we don't currently gather information and then set the trend and then require carriers to use that trend or explain a deviation from it.
Oh, you do it backwards.
But, well, I mean, we are studying, you know, industry sources, the available data that we have. It's not as granular as what the carriers typically have available to the, you know, internally. But we look at the data that we have to figure out what do we think is a reasonable range of trend assumptions, you know, in terms of the year-over-year growth in medical costs. It can, you know, our actuaries have really opined that it can vary for, you know, good reason from entity to entity depending on different factors, but that we think that the range is pretty narrow. So we've really tried to, rather than pick a trend number, we've said there's a range that we think is reasonable, and we do ask carriers to justify why they should be lower or higher, even if they're kind of appropriately justifying within the range. So we do that currently.
But you don't give it to them in advance.
I mean, we do not.
You could give them that range, all right, not a single number. Give them that range in advance and let them to explain why they pick wherever they are picking within that range or outside of that range.
So, Mr. Chair, you're correct. We do not do that in advance. I will note that the last couple of years that range has been pretty consistent, so I don't think that there's been a huge surprise to the carriers when they've seen, you know, what, you know, that hasn't changed year over year, just because we haven't seen real significant change in the underlying data to tell us that range should be different.
But right now you got this sort of hidden answer, and you guys make a guess and then we'll tell you how you match up with a hidden answer we don't want to tell you about. It seems very perverse.
Well, Mr. Chair, I assure you that we're not trying to make the carriers guess what our answer is, but often we're studying that information at the same time that the carriers are too, so we may not necessarily have information before they do to kind of set that expectation. The one thing I wanted to mention, though, just kind of back to the conversation we were having about potential stabilization ideas, one of the ideas we were considering, you know, before we decided to push pause is, do we need to look at not just with trend but with other factors, you know, having more of a global analysis of what kind of the average cost to cover claims for the individual market looks like, and basically ask, you know, carriers to justify deviations from that. I mean, that's an idea that we've floated as, I mean, it goes even beyond trend. A trend would be a factor in that, but also really looking at, you know, if we know generally how much it costs to cover an average person in our individual market, should we be looking at that as a benchmark and asking our market to justify, and there might be good reason to be higher or lower, but we would ask for justification of why that should vary. So that would mean it was an idea we floated. So, I mean, it's something that, you know, we're considering how we can help with less fluctuation that isn't driven by real, you know, by real differences in kind of the delivery of care.
If I could just make a couple of comments to expand on that for a couple of members who are on business and labor, what Commissioner Calley just described is actually making the health insurance filing system work much more like the workers' compensation filing system works, where we set the baseline, and then there are deviations from that baseline. And from our standpoint, that's borrowing some key features from what is a very successful system. The other thing that it kind of picks up on is that we learned through the experience of getting carriers back into some geography was one of the things that was driving one of the things that was having an impact on reluctance to do that was the fact that wide spreads in rates between carriers was threatening to the carriers. It's not an attractive position if you're trying to manage and cap your risk to find yourself in a blind filing system to be, by a long distance, the low carrier on the price point, because you tend to get all of the business. And we came to realize that a narrower spread of rates may actually be more in the public interest than wide spreads in rates, which is a little bit counterintuitive, but really kind of played itself out in those rural counties.
Yeah, we'll have some more discussions on this, but I think that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Is somebody down here?
I'm good.
Okay, well, keep up the good work, guys.
Thank you very much
for coming in. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2341 and 2342. Any other comments from the committee? We are adjourned.
Wow.
I thought we were going to be.
It wasn't so long.